ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Let's talk about another place where Anzac Day ceremonies are held. Every year, historian and author Lynette Ramsey-Silver organises and escorts a not-for-profit tour group to Malaysian Borneo for Anzac Day. In the late 1990s, Lynette began telling the story of Sandakan. Her research led to her book, Sandakan, A Conspiracy of Silence. It was released in 1998, which brought to light the sacrifice of almost 2,500 Allied POWs in what was then called British North Borneo. And, of course, brought to our attention the horrendous Sandakan death marches, regarded as the greatest single atrocity committed against Australians in war. Before her efforts, their fate had almost been forgotten. Only six men survived to tell the story after the war, and there were issues in who was telling the story and what as well. Lynette organised an unofficial dawn service there in 1999. It was the first since the war, and she's continued to visit, taking relatives and descendants of the POWs to the site. And in 2007, the Australian government came on board and holds an official Anzac Dawn service ceremony there. And they've been happening ever since. Lynette's again in Borneo. She joins us now from Sabah, which was formerly, as I say, British North Borneo. Lynette Silver, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's terrific to have you back as well. It's been a while since we had a chat.
Well, you sound like you're in the next room, not thousands of miles away.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Isn't the magic of what we can do? We can do these days. Gee, it must have seemed like a long way away at the time, wasn't it? Look, another commemorative service today. Describe it. It's held on the site of the POW camp, isn't it?
Yes, the POW camp's been preserved as a memorial park, and it's held in the open around a beautiful black granite memorial, absolutely magnificent. And the chairs are arranged, and you have the canopy of the trees above, a bit like being in, a leafy cathedral.
Yeah.
And we're there before we actually see the sunrise, and the atmosphere is phenomenally good. It's beautiful, even though the things that happened there were absolutely horrific.
Yeah. No, horrendous, as we'll talk about in a moment. How many people were there, Lynette?
Oh, about 200 this year, I'd say, 200 to 300. A lot of locals come, which is good.
Yeah.
And we had probably about 60 Aussies, I guess.
Isn't that great? The service remembers, of course, not only the Australian and British soldiers held as prisoners of war of the Japanese during the Second World War, but, as you say, the locals too, who worked and aided and also died with them as well. Who officiates and who was representing Australia, Lynette?
Well, it's organised by the Office of Australian War Graves,
right,
who looks after the overseas cemeteries and memorials. They actually organise it. And dignitaries come. There have been quite a lot of local ones, of course. And this year we had the Assistant Minister for Defence come across, and he spoke very, very well indeed. And we get, of course, the Australian High Commission. And this year we didn't have the British because it was Australia's turn to host Anzac Garden and Kuala Lumpur.
Right.
And so when that happens, of course, they're busy up there. But Sabah is interesting in that Malaysia, you have West Malaysia, which is the old Malaya that we knew, and East Malaysia, which has Sarawak and Sabah. And normally you would only have one Anzac Day service for one country. Because it's split up, we have the two.
Yeah. I mentioned the local people. I mean, this was a horrendous aspect of the whole affair, wasn't it, too? I mean, I think this is right. About 16% of the local population died under Japanese rule?
Yes, they died. Well, they died because they were murdered, executed, beheaded, but also died of starvation. And when the 9th Division came after the war had finished with naval ships and whatnot, bringing food in, the locals were in a terrible state that babies died in the arms of their mothers while waiting in the queue to get the food. It was absolutely terrible.
Horrendous.
And they were punished severely, of course, for helping Australian prisoners of war. Eight were shot by a firing squad for that. And we had one, the senior Australian involved, was also executed at the same time. So, yes, the locals suffered terrifically and took the most amazing risks. The six that survived only survived because local people in the villages hid them.
Mm.
And one group was hidden for about 5 weeks. Now, for Japanese had a price on the heads of all these people. And had they found these prisoners of war in these villages, everybody in the village would have been killed.
Yeah.
So, it's a really a massive thing when you think about it. I mean, how many of us at home in Australia would, with a knock at the door on a dark night and someone saying that they needed help, and you knew that to help them was going to cost your life, all your family and everyone in the street? I mean, it's amazing that they actually did it.
Mm. I said it was probably the worst single atrocity committed against Australians in war. Tell us, there can't be too many people, but there will be, Lynette. There'll be people who are not familiar with the Sandakan story. Remind us once again of the brutal history of this place. How did it all begin and what happened?
Well, there were two groups sent from Singapore because the Japanese suddenly found they had thousands and thousands of POWs and they wanted to make use of their work. And as most people know, a lot was sent up on the Burma Thai Railway. The two groups were sent, from Singapore and a group of English, which made the camp population about 2,700. Now, there were a few transfers and that brought it down to about 2,500. Now, it was quite good at the beginning. It was quite a good camp.
What was that? What were they set to work to? Because they were sent there to work, weren't they?
They sent there to build an airstrip, which of course was against the Geneva Convention because it was military. So they slaved away on the airstrip during the day, and for the first 18 months it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Japanese discovered that the Australians had a radio, and also they were in cahoots with the local underground movement, and that's when it all fell apart. People were dragged off and tortured and names were given and it was a terrible purge took place. And as a result, a number of Australians were sent to jail in Singapore and some didn't survive. One was executed, of course, plus eight locals. And from then on, life became very difficult for those left behind because all the security was much tightened and the guards were more brutal. And by 1945, the food situation was very bad because the Americans had cut off all the shipping and the Japanese decided to move 400-odd across to the other side of Borneo, make use of their labour. Mm. Now, this was a trek ended up being a trek of 265 kilometres because they didn't reach the other coast, they were kept in the middle. And that march took them between 14 and 18 days, marching 10 miles a day. Sometimes they had no food at all, and about a quarter of them actually died on the way. Either they just died or they couldn't go any further, and the Japanese shot them.
Yeah.
The survivors reached the end, but conditions there were so bad that by June of 1945, left in January and February, there were only six left out of the 400-plus had left Sandakan.
Mm.
And they were joined by remnants of another march that started out with more than 500. Two-thirds of them died on the way or were shot.
Mm.
And eventually there was this little group left which dwindled and dwindled from lack of food and brutality until the 15th of August. There were 15 left alive out of almost 1,000.
What was the point of the march, Lynette? What were they marching to? I mean, what were the Japanese trying to achieve?
Well, the first march was to make use of their labour on the west coast, but because the Allies were bombing it, and they didn't want the prisoners anywhere near that, they stopped them unexpectedly at a place called Ramau, where no provision made, just this sort of empty native hut. That was it. By the time the second march came, actually we precipitated the second march because on the 27th of May we bombed the daylights out of the place here and PT boats came from the Philippines and the Japanese were convinced that invasion was going to come from the east, from the Philippines. Actually, it was a feint to draw attention away from the west coast because on the 10th of June the Allied landings took place over there and they then fought to get to liberate what was then British North Borneo. So the Japanese decided, thinking that there was going to be an invasion in a very short space of time, pulled back to the interior, and they took all the prisoners who could still walk, and I use the term loosely, with them. I mean, some of them were hobbling along with ulcers on their legs so big that all the shin bones were exposed. And about 300 were left behind because they were too sick to go.
And they were just basically left out in the open, weren't they? They were just left there.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they were left there with some ambulance men. They all thought, though, the prisoners all thought that in a couple of days that the Aussies would arrive and they'd be liberated. They were convinced. Japanese were too. Hmm. So the second march was to get them away from the planned invasion and take them into the interior where the Japanese were going to make their last stand. So these prisoners were in most shocking condition. It took a whole month. They only used to walk about 5 miles a day, to about 8 kilometres, in 8 hours. So, you know, very, very slow. And they died in large numbers and were shot on the way. It was shocking, a terrible experience. Mm. And when they reached the end, of course, it was the end. It was the end of them.
What happened at the end?
Well, there were still 15 left alive after the war finished. Mm. And on the 27th of August, which was 12 days after the war ended, the five officers were told they were going to have talks with the Kempe Tai, the secret police, up in Ranau, which was about 8 kilometres away. And the rank and file, 10 of them, were told they were going to go and collect some vegetables. So they left in good, fairly good spirits, thinking, well, the war's over, this is it. And they only went a short distance, the officers, when the Japanese shot them all dead, the five of them. And then the rank and file were taken one at a time. They were told they were to die. Right. And they were taken one at a time down a side track and all shot through the head. And that wiped out everybody. All we had was the six who'd managed to escape.
That's right. The six of them who managed, astonishingly, to get away, didn't they?
Yes. Two went independently on the second march and were helped by local people and hidden. And the other four escaped from the Ranau end and were hidden by people living in the hills. And by the time we the Australians, got in there with, you know, rescued them, they were almost dead. That really, they didn't. The people rescuing them did not think that they'd probably last the night. But they did, and lived to tell the tale. But unfortunately, when they came home, I mean, they were in very poor condition. They were in hospital for a long time. They were told to forget about the war and get on with their lives.
Yeah.
So they were these people with these terrible memories were in isolation from each other, and they didn't actually meet up till the 1980s.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Meet each other again.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Yeah, it harks back to this thing that happened after the war, which is hard to kind of process now. As to why, you know, so many of these atrocities were not pursued after the war, but there was a great sense of just drawing a line under it, wasn't there? And just moving on. Everyone can just move on now.
Yes, well, our war crimes investigators are very tenacious. Huge pressure was put on the Australian government by the British, then the Americans, to not carry out any war crimes.
That's right. They wanted us to drop it, didn't they? Yeah.
Yes, but we persisted. And Menzies was the Prime Minister then, and he said, no way, Jose. So did the RSL, and we continued with the war crimes trials until 1951, when the last of them were hanged up in Rabaul. And that included General Barber, who was the commanding officer of the 37th Army, which was in occupation in here in Sabah. And this morning I was very surprised to be introduced to two Japanese men. Like, we'd never had any Japanese people at the service before. And I just asked, you know, the older one, whether his family had been in Tokyo during the war. He told me that he was the grandson of General Barber.
Wow.
Which was very, very confronting, I can tell you.
You better, I know who General Barber is. You better tell us who General Barber is. Yeah.
Well, he was the one that was the commanding officer of Sabah, and he was hanged in Rabaul.
Yeah.
So there was his grandson. His grandson had come as an act of reconciliation.
Yeah. It's not just that, is it?
Nice.
It's not just that, is it? I mean, there's also a realisation these days that a lot of Japanese soldiers, I mean, who were, you know, profoundly following orders and probably didn't feel much agency at all, that a lot of those Japanese soldiers were killed by their own officers, were shot by their own officers too. I mean,
well, the standing order for the army at the time, military, was anybody in retreat who cannot keep up is to be disposed of. They always use the words disposed of. And that meant their own men. So on the 1st of March, we had groups of 50 going, 50 each day for 9 days, accompanied by 50 soldiers, regulars. And at the end of that march, 15 prisoners had died. About between 8 and 12 Japanese had died and been shot. And on the second march, it was exactly the same. Owen Campbell said, they're shooting their own men. And that was just taken as standard, whereas in the Western world, you know, that's totally alien to our way of thinking.
Yeah, indeed. Back in 1999, when you decided to start these services, Lynette, it was a pretty different scene. How many people were there at that first service?
I had 16 people with a little little tiny recorder to play the anthems, and some of those silky, quite cheap bags that you can get, you know, at the chain stores. I bought a piece of, had a bit of this washing line, and we stretched that between two trees and hanged the flags up there, and the 16 of us stood in this little group and held the Anzac Day service. And I did that with my husband for 8 years. And by that time, with the help of the ABC and also the Sydney Morning Herald, who reported what I was doing, we raised the profile sufficiently for the government to agree to give a second service in Malaysia.
Yeah.
So since then, the government's taken over. I mean, I was pleased because what's going to happen when I can't come anymore? It'll just fizzle out. And now it's definitely entrenched on the cap in the same way as Goodly is.
Lynette Ramsey-Silver's with us, an historian and author. Lynette's spoken with us on the show before about the Sandakan death marches. She's speaking to us from Sabah in Borneo, where there was an Anzac service, as she's describing, to remember those who suffered and died in one of the worst atrocities of the Second World War, the Sandakan death marches. When you were there, well, when you take a tour group these days, Lynette, who comes on the tour? Are they family members or?
Oh, mostly. Sometimes we just get people interested in war history, but they're mostly relatives of the prisoners of war. Anyway, not a week goes past. This is 80 years since the war ended now. Not a week goes past that I don't receive two or three emails asking me, do I know what happened to, you know, great Uncle Charlie? And, you know, because it was kept quiet for so long, it was such an awful atrocity that the government of the day, plus the army, decided that the relatives of these men, who'd been very worried for 3.5 years about them being prisoners of war, to tell them what actually happened here was just too distressing. So they just sent out a telegram to say they died while prisoners of war, and virtually no details were given. So it wasn't until I did my book and traced what happened to everybody that the floodgates opened, and I was absolutely inundated for months and months, people writing to me or ringing me up to ask me what exactly happened to their relatives.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a terrible situation for them because it impacts on their family. It's a bit like dropping a rock and a little pebble into a pond. You know, the ripples go on. And it's not just the first generation that's affected, it's probably up to two or three.
Yeah.
And we have people who have come for great uncles and grand uncles and whatnot. And, you know, they've lived all their lives not really knowing. So to come over here and actually see what it was is very liberating.
I can imagine.
It's very confronting, but it's very liberating.
It is confronting, but it's liberating as well. I get that. Lynette, it's always great speaking with you, and thank you for your work, and particularly thanks for your time this evening. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope we talk again soon.
We will. Don't worry. Lynette Silver, historian and author, speaking to us live from Sabah in Borneo, commemorating the Anzac Dawn service there, the horrendous Sandakan death marches. Lynette's website, by the way, is Lynette Silver, LynetteSilver, Silver as in the metal, LynetteSilver.com. If you want some more information.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.